to make you a better worker in the office. Remember, other people are going to live with you. So if you're peaceful and calm and sensitive, you're such an easier person to live with. So that gives you the motivation to do meditation, to become a better mum, a more sensitive parent, a better wife, a better worker in the office. I'll go through this quickly because I'm going over time. I seem to be reflecting and repenting more than meditating. Is meditating a not thinking state? Thank you. Yeah, I mean, reflecting is a time to reflect, but not yet. When a scientist does an experiment, he doesn't or she doesn't interpret the data until all the results are in. The problem with us is that as soon as we get even a slight little thing, we want to reflect upon it and work it all out. At this stage, you're just collecting data, collecting experience, so shut up and just watch. Watch silently, because if you watch silently, you can see what you don't expect to see. If you think too much, you're looking for something. And what you're looking for usually doesn't exist. What you don't expect, that's what truth is. So, now is not the right time to reflect. That's just indulging in more thinking. Now is not the right time to repent. Let go of the past. You'll find this was, I mentioned this I think in the BSV, there was an article in the newspaper which was reporting an experiment done in the United States. A psychologist, an elderly man, remembered that in 1967 he'd interviewed a large number of 14-year-old children to find out what was happening to them in their home, whether they loved their father more or their mother more, whether they were disciplined with corporal punishment, whether they felt happy in their home, whether they were good at their studies, and had all the results still in his files. And he managed to find about, I think, 67 of these children. And this was 40-odd years later, or 33 years later. So they were, 47-year-olds. And he gave them the same questionnaire. Did your parents discipline you corporally when you were children? Did you love your mother? Did you feel happy at home? And he could compare the answers to when they were 14-year-olds. And the amazing thing was that what these people today thought of their childhood bore no resemblance at all to what they said when they were actually in childhood. Even something, what you think will be a clear memory, like, were you disciplined by your parents? At the time, I think 80% said yes, but 30, 40 years down the track, only about 20% said yes. Did you feel happy at home when they were 14? About 70% said, yeah, they were happy at home. But now, 30 or 40 years down the track, only about 20% said they were happy at home. Their memories of childhood were not the same as the reality of childhood. And this was the wonderful thing, was that what we take to be memory is just so unreliable, really you can't really take it seriously. So when you have repentance, I did something very bad when I was a child. The fact is you may not even have done that at all. Or the circumstances might be completely different than you remember. You cannot trust those memories. Even your own memories, not the ones which are brought up by therapists or through hypnosis. Just the ordinary memories. I don't know what you think of your childhood, but now all my memories of childhood, I don't know whether they were true or not. They're unreliable. So when they're unreliable, why are you giving them so much importance as if they were true? It's a strange thing. You think they were true. And you really think that that actually happened. Well, this psychologist was actually proving that what you thought happened, even that you know you might have been beaten by your parents, it's not as you remember it. Be careful. So repentance is not really a good thing to do, unless it's something you just did this morning or something. Certainly guilt is no point to that. Please explain what a quiet what quiet should do at the moment. Okay. Please explain what a quiet should do, or a guest should do. At the moment, just try to stay with Buddha. But anyway, what you should do is nothing. But don't do the meditation, just get out of the way and allow it to happen. Because we always want to do things, and you can't make yourself quiet. You try and do it, it just gets all noisy. So any time in the meditation, when you think, what should I be doing? You've already missed the point. Just watch and allow things to quieten down. The doing is making the leaf flutter. The not doing is leaving the leaf alone, and it gets less and less and less and less. Don't do so much. Just sit here. If I'm getting a backache, is it all right to sit in a position other than cross-legged? Yes, certainly. Sit on a chair or lean against a wall, that's fine. So be kind to your body. How do you know you're in jhana? If you doubt, you're certainly not in jhana. If you're thinking, you're not in jhana. If you can hear the noise outside, you're not in jhana. When you're in jhana, you don't know you're in jhana. It's only afterwards. After you come out, you look and see, what was that? And if you look after you've come out of deep states of meditation, all the reflection should be done at the very end. What was that? Only then do you realize I wasn't hearing anything. I couldn't feel my body. I was completely blissed out. At one point, you had no thoughts at all. And you realize that you've got to all these stages in the right order. You've let go. The mind is very powerful and very blissful. And you've been in that state a long period of time. If you've only been there just a moment, that's never jhana. These are long states of long periods where you get into these states. And I know that you've been in jhana. You'd have this big silly smile on your face for hours and hours and hours and hours. Okay. What's all the questions today? Is there any other ones which someone wants to ask before we finish off this evening? Yes? In the meditation retreat, you can live in the present moment 99% of the time. When you go back out into the world, there are times when you've got to plan the future and think about the past. The point is that have the ability to at times be in the present. I call it like lunchtime. In lunchtime, the morning work is finished. So you don't worry about what's happening in the morning. The afternoon work is yet to happen, so you don't go planning and thinking about the afternoon work. Now is your lunchtime, you sit down and enjoy your meal. This is rest. That's what lunchtime is supposed to be. A rest. It's like playtime at school. Then the morning lesson is finished, the next lesson is yet to arrive, so you can play. And if you had at school just lesson after lesson after lesson after lesson, would the children ever be able to learn anything? They need rest. They need playtime. So do we. If we don't have playtime, rest, present moment awareness, just enjoying our lunch, not thinking or worrying about our work, we get stressed. We can't perform at work. So have lunchtime, present moment awareness, from time to time in your life. But you don't always, not like some of these businessmen who are legends in their own lunchtime, not just having lunch for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. Do your work, but have the balance of rest as well. Make sense? It's great to be able to take time off, even at home. Even if it's 5 minutes. Just be. Not thinking what you're going to do next. Not worrying about what's happened already. Just come into the present moment. This mindfulness of now. And give you a rest. And then afterwards you can do your jobs. Yeah, that's right, that's the present moment. I'm seeing something. It's being the present moment, I'm seeing it now. When you see something, it may be like some dirt in your kitchen. You don't say, I've got to go and clean this. It's later. It's all right to have a dirty kitchen for a little while. One of the stories from the suttas, there was this young monk staying with an arahat, Mahakachana. And this young monk would be so diligent, he'd always be sweeping the vihara. He'd sweep it all day. And the vihara was spotless. But after a few weeks, this great arahat put this young monk aside and said, look, what you're doing is very good. You're keeping this vihara so spotless and it's so wonderful to look at, but you didn't become a monk to have a spotless vihara. You became a monk to have a spotless mind. Now, sleep maybe an hour or two in the morning, an hour or two in the evening, but during the middle of the day, do some meditation. He taught him meditation. And this young monk soon became an arahat. The vihara was never as clean as it was before, but we had one more enlightened being in the world. So the purpose of life is not to have a spotless kitchen. The purpose of life is to have a spotless mind. So keep priorities in order. Okay? So it's time to clean the kitchen. It's time to say, enough. That's my meditation time.
While on the kitchen, if you hear something, you observe that.
You can observe it, yes. But don't make anything of it. Don't allow it to echo. Don't have a ping pong. You know, when you hear someone, like someone coughs, and they've always been coughing right next to you. You say, why can't this be real? They shouldn't come to the retreat. They should sort of stay outside if they're coughing. They shouldn't do this. And don't go into a conversation with the what happened. As soon as the coughing stops, you stop. As soon as a bird stops singing, you don't hear it anymore. You can observe that, that's fine. But make sure that they don't echo in the mind. Or they don't start a train of thought. You know, that's this bird, that's that bird. I think it was a crow this morning, wasn't there? Instead of saying, crows are just lousy birds, they shouldn't be allowed to. You know, crows are like rebirth of people who talk too much or say bad things about other people. That's why they've got this this terrible sound. Like, don't go thinking like that, because what that is doing is taking the present moment and allowing it to sort of start a train of thought. So any sensation, any sound, any feeling, as soon as the sound goes, it doesn't echo. That's present moment awareness. Okay. Well, thanks for those questions. We'll need some more tomorrow night, I hope. So the night is still young. How much did you pay for this retreat? I didn't pay anything. But remember to get your money's worth, because if you go to sleep, I mean, you're not really getting the sort of the full value for money. It's, you know, money's not easy to come by these days, and so you don't want to sort of waste your money by sleeping. You know, when you go home, you can sleep. Now be gentle with yourself, and if you want to carry on meditating, you can. If you feel energy, just carry on meditating, and don't worry about getting up at 4:30. We're not going to have any bells. Except what I do here. Everyone knows the time for breakfast. No one has ever late for breakfast. And it means that in the morning, that you can stay up late if you want to. You know, if you meditate 10, 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning if you wish to. And it means that in the morning time, at get up 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, or just 7 o'clock, whichever. So just balance your practice. And if you're a late night person, you can stay up late. If you want to go to bed now, you can get up early in the morning and be the first one in here. That way that you are working according to your schedule rather than somebody else's. So just enjoy the evening and the morning. Thank you. Questions. emotions. Just a small little few words about the meditation before we actually begin the question time. Just during the day here, sometimes it's very warm, and sometimes people who are sitting meditation in here come in and go out. So during the retreat period, please feel free to meditate in your rooms if you wish to, because there you have a bit of solitude. It's like being in your monk or nun cell in that little room. Or meditate outside. You don't have to meditate in this room, and no one is checking on you. So feel free to adapt, you know, where you sit and how you sit according to how you feel comfortable. The first question, Venerable Sir, my meditation is not going well at all. Can I ask for your money back? Resentful thoughts arise from the subconscious and disturb my present moment awareness. I know this is a form of craving, thoughts from the past, but I have tried to come back to the present moment only to have these thoughts arising again. I have to wait for my turn for my interview with you, so I would be grateful if you would advise me how to proceed. Thank you. It's a strange thing, as I mentioned earlier, that whatever thoughts come up, whether resentful thoughts or angry thoughts, you often wonder why it is these thoughts come up in the mind, and the only reason is because people enjoy those thoughts. Even angry thoughts, the Buddha said, have a certain degree of pleasure attached to them, and that's why people get angry, because they literally enjoy getting angry. But this is like a pleasure which gives you a sense of purpose and a sense of identity in the moment, and you feel good about being angry, you feel alive. It gives you a certain sense of kick, but then it has terrible side effects afterwards. It sort of burns you in many different ways. Same with resentment as well. If it's resenting sort of the people sitting next to you, or resenting the place, or even resenting yourself. Remember, resentment is like judgment, it's anger. So what you can use is, when these thoughts come up, use thoughts to overcome thoughts. So the first thing you can do is to use a sense of substitution. You've got resentful thoughts coming up because you see the person sitting next to you that sits so still, and they've been sitting there for so long, and they've got this big smile on their face, and they've never given dana, but you have. And then you start to get resentful. You know, substitute that with the opposite of resentment, which is mudita. Isn't it wonderful that someone's having a very happy time doing this retreat? I'm so glad that they're sort of getting into jhana, and I'm so glad they're getting into enlightenment before me. Or whatever else it is which gives rise to a sense of like appreciation of noble qualities, good qualities. So you take unskillful thoughts and you change them by skillful ones. Or, if it's that doesn't work, just like investigate the causes of resentment. Why are you getting resentful to that person or to your situation you're in? And so often it's just a case of the fault-finding mind. For those of you who've come from Perth, or even those of you here, you've heard me tell the story so many times about my brick wall at the monastery at Serpentine. The brick wall in a nutshell. When I first went to the monastery in Serpentine, we didn't have any money, we were in debt, so as a monk I had to learn how to build. I still have to do building these days as well. I had to learn how to mix concrete, lay bricks, put on a roof, do plumbing. All of the sewer plumbing in that monastery I did myself. It works. The power of a monk. And sometimes people wonder about what's like a senior monk doing, fixing drain pipes. It's part of the job. It keeps me humble. I call it life in the gutter. But anyhow, when I started to lay bricks, and many of you know this story, it was time consuming. It took me a long time to lay the bricks properly. nice and level with all the rest of the bricks. But when I finished my first brick wall, I looked back in horror, because somehow or other I'd missed two bricks. Instead of being level like all the other bricks, these two bricks were at an angle. And they stood out so badly they spoiled the whole wall. And I was so upset with that brick wall I wanted to demolish it. If there was a bulldozer available, I'd have told the bulldozer driver to push it over or to blow it up, because it spoiled the whole wall. And I'd done that, and I was responsible. And I felt so bad about that brick wall that when visitors would come, I'd always take them somewhere else so they wouldn't see my mistakes. And it was only after a couple of months, a visitor came with me, they saw that brick wall, they said, that was a nice brick wall. And I said, can't you see the... Oh, no, first of all, I said, have you left your glasses in your car? Are you blind? Can't you see the two bad bricks? And what they said, the important part of this story, which many of you know, they say, yes, I can see the two bad bricks, but I can also see the 998 good bricks as well. And that was the first time in a couple of months that I saw anything in that wall other than the two bad bricks. Every time I looked at that wall, my eyes went to my mistakes. And that's why I wanted to destroy the wall. That's why I was ashamed of it. That's why it was giving me so much suffering. When someone else came and pointed out, look, there's other bricks in that wall, other than the two mistakes, only then could I see those other bricks. It was like a whole wall was opening out to me, but all I'd seen was two bad bricks. And when I saw the 998 good bricks on either side of that wall, of that bad bricks, then it didn't look so bad anymore. I didn't want to destroy it. In the same way, anger and resentment is all about seeing two bad bricks and literally being blind to anything else. You're resentful about the person sitting next to you, or you're angry about somebody. All you're seeing is one or two acts of stupidity, if they're that, and you're blind to anything good about the other person. I'm not sure if you remember that scene from The Life of Brian, where they're trying to get rid of the Romans. What have the Romans ever done for us? Well, there's law and order now. Yes, but what have the Romans ever done except law and order? There's sewage. Yeah, what about what they've done for us other than law and order and sewage? They built roads. It's really good to have roads now. Your carriages don't break their wheels. But what have they done other than roads, sewage, and law and order? They've got schools. Yeah, but what have they done other than roads, law and order, sewage, and schools? Nothing. They've done nothing. Out with the Romans. Husband, what have you done for me? Got you looked after your children. I've been kind to you. I've gone out to work and got the home, got the food. Yeah, what have you done other than that? Nothing. Out with you. Get rid of your husband. Whatever it is. Or your wife. Whatever it is. Don't you see the anger? Is like a selected perception. You're only seeing one side of the story. And it's a strange psychology that when you only see two bad bricks, that's all you can see. It's a part of perception which rules out seeing anything other than what you're looking for. And this is a problem with resentment, anger, guilt. The guilt which you might have. When you feel guilty, what do you feel guilty about? A couple of bad bricks in your life. What lie either side of those faults? All the wonderful things you've done. All the great acts of charity and kindness and compassion. But we don't remember those, do we? When we're guilty, we focus on two bad bricks. I did this terrible thing, I did that terrible thing. We can't see anything else. And what do we want to do? We want to destroy the wall. We want to destroy ourselves and stop ourselves getting happy. So instead of just allowing resentment to fester, we can't substitute resentment with these lovely brahmaviharas of loving kindness and compassion, forgiveness. We can actually use thought to overcome thought. Say, well, look, what else is with that other person, that object of resentment? Can you see anything good there? Can you see any good bricks in that wall? If you look, you can see. Once you see those good bricks in the wall, resentment goes. Once you see the good bricks in your life so far, Sure, you've made a couple of mistakes. How many good things have you done? I make mistakes all the time. A few weeks ago, a bit longer than that, I think, that a Sri Lankan family came to do a service for their father who died. And as I was doing the service, I sort of did some chanting and did a bit of ceremonies, and so I want to dedicate this merit to your mother who's passed away. And then his hand sort of shot up and said, I'm not dead yet, it's my husband who died. I got it mixed up, it was the father, not the mother. So I laugh at that, it's good fun sometimes making mistakes. But I don't feel guilty about them, that's the thing. You don't feel resentful about them. So, you know, maybe some other monk has a nice time, they don't have to come and give retreats, they can sit in their cave somewhere. I don't get resentful about that. Good luck to them. I'm doing my thing with teaching, so don't have resentment. You can turn it around to what a wonderful opportunity this is to practice compassion. What a wonderful opportunity this is to do some meditation, just to be peaceful. So if you look very carefully, you can actually turn resentment by using thought, using other thought, to overcome resentment. But also use thought to say, well, why do I keep getting into resentment? Now, what's the attraction with resentment there? And a lot of times, whether it's resentment or whether it's anger or any other thoughts, the root cause of not being able to be in the present moment is because you're afraid of the present moment. You're afraid of you. We're always trying to run away from ourselves, run away from the moment. Instead of just being, we want to be somewhere else, anywhere else. If resentment won't do, then anger will do, or guilt will do. Well, let's go planning. If that doesn't work, let's go look in the fridge, see what's in the fridge. Let's go and surf the net. Let's go and see what's on the TV. We're always trying to escape from the moment, from just being in the present moment. And this is where I have to be a good sales monk, and to try and convince everybody that the present moment is really beautiful. It's much better than the world of resentment, much better than the world of anger, much better than the world of fantasy, much better than the world of planning. So just come and join me in the present moment. It's a wonderful place to hang out in. It's just so free of so many problems. And if you can delight in the present moment, then resentful thoughts just haven't got a chance of coming in. Angry thoughts haven't got a chance of coming in. You're having too good a time. When you're watching your favourite soap opera, do you get resentful thoughts? Are you enjoying what you're doing? You've got no time for resentful thoughts. If you're having a wonderful dinner, do you get resentful thoughts? You're enjoying the taste of the food. Or you're listening to a beautiful piece of music. Can you get angry, resentful thoughts then? Not at all, because you're enjoying the moment. So, when you get resentful thoughts like that, sort of, those are two ways to overcome them. Just substitute nice thoughts. Don't try and get rid of all thoughts, just substitute nice thoughts. Or just investigate resentful thoughts and just see how you're judging unfairly. But then, later on, ask yourself, why do these things keep on disturbing me? Why do I keep running away from the present moment? Is there any questions on that? Okay, for the next one. I know you are a monk, but are you also a priest? I don't mind being whatever people want me to be. Really good fun being a monk or a priest or whatever you're supposed to be, because sometimes that people think that they think all sorts of things about you as a monk. Sometimes they think that you've got magic powers and stuff. Just the last time I was visiting my mother in England, I was just in her flat in London, and there was a knock on the door, and this gypsy lady came to the door. They do this in London. And she said, I'm selling like little bits of heather for good luck. And I said, no, we don't need that, thank you. And then she started getting aggressive. And she said, look, if you don't buy this, I'll put a gypsy curse on you. And so I said, look, I'm a Buddhist monk. My curses are much stronger than yours. I've only joked, but she ran away. She left us alone. Well, that's fun sometimes, being a monk or a big priest. And so it really doesn't really matter if they call you a monk or call you a priest. You know, what's in the name anyway? If you call you, you're okay there. Okay. Because like a Buddhist monk is, we call it like a monk, but many other people go around the world calling themselves monks. And really, if you're a monk, there's two important things which you should have as a monk. Two important rules. Basically, celibacy, because that's what everyone understands as a monk, celibate. And number two is like simplicity, frugality, which means like literally no money. And if you have those two rules, then I'd say you're a monk or a nun. If you haven't got those two rules, if you've got a whole load of antique cars somewhere, or you've got a big bank account, even though you haven't got money in your pocket, if you've got a credit card, or you're sexually active, you're not a monk. You're not a nun. Even like a small monk. You know what a small monk is called? No vice. Love it, for those of you slow. But I it's a good name, no vice. But I also a priest. I said, what a priest does is, like priestcraft, you don't have to be celibate to be a priest. You don't have to be have no money to be a priest. Like, you know, a priest is just someone who's literally, in the English language, is some intermediary between some powerful forces, like gods, or like, you know, magic demons or something, and ordinary human beings. And that's why priests charge a lot of money. So, really, I wouldn't really say you were a priest. You know, a monk is a much nicer name, like a monk and a teacher, or a novice. They don't really care what people call me, monk, reverend, priest, whatever. Okay, that's the next one. Why is there always more females than males at a retreat? Or at a talk? Does it mean women are more religious? Thank you. That's a nice curly question, isn't it? It depends on the teacher, doesn't it? I remember going to give some talks in one particular school, and at this particular school they were having like representatives of all the different religions. You know, like it was someone from the Islamic religion, Hindu religion, Jewish religion, and I was represented from the Buddhist religion. It was a girls' school. And after I finished, the teacher took me aside and said, "They really like what you said, but you weren't as good as the Muslim." And I said, "Why was that?" And he said, "Because the Muslim was 6 foot tall, had blue eyes and blonde hair. It was a girls' school." They weren't at all interested in what you were saying, just what you look like. So I hope that's nothing to do with why there's more women on retreats. It's like the Rolling Stones used to get more women at their concerts as well. But now I think a lot of times, see, it's not that. Actually, this is quite strange. In Perth, it's usually pretty even. You've got just about the same number of males and females. So I think it's important that when a person teaches meditation or teaches any religion, they don't aim it just as females, but they also aim it at the males as well. So it's acceptable to all of the different genders. There are some gender differences which I've noticed over the years with religion. And one of the interesting things which I've found, this is just experience, it's not theory at all, is that generally speaking, women have a much easier time in meditation. They can get into deep meditations more often than the males can. But, you know, it all works out in the end because when the women do get into those jhanas, they have a harder time understanding them, whereas the, generally speaking, the males can actually gain much more insight from this. So it's, you know, usually swings and roundabouts. But it's an interesting point. I contemplated that why it was that there's more women disciples were getting into the deep meditations than males. And basically it's because to attain those deep meditations you have to trust in more of the emotional side of the mind. You've got to feel your way into jhanas rather than think your way. And to be able to trust in the powerful emotions of bliss which start coming up in the deep stages of meditation, it's much easier, for women to not get scared. Because for men it's something very powerful, something which is like an emotion. Emotional surge inside, it's beautiful ecstasy. And you have to be very wise to be able to take that on and not be afraid. Why more females like retreat or go to churches? That's actually, I think, just the problem of marketing, that's all. And if the talks or the meditation was aimed properly, I think it would appeal to equally to males and females. There's no essential difference between them, obviously. The main reason is because when you get to that mind inside, the mind hasn't got a gender. Interesting point of Buddhist cosmology. In the different heaven realms, you know, which a person gets reborn into, the gender stops at what's called the Parinimitta Vasavati realm. That's the gods who wield power over other people's creations. That's one of the realms where Mara lives. The realm above that, the Brahma gods, is based on the experience of at least first jhana. And in those realms, that's where gender finishes. These are realms of the mind. And this is not just allegory. This is what happens. When you get into deep meditation, you actually go way beyond the body, wherein lies gender, and you go to what's common between all genders, even all beings. That's what we call citta or mind. And when you get to that stage of your meditation, just like beings reborn in those heaven realms, you go way beyond gender. And there is no difference at all. So that's why if you talk at that level in Buddhism, then you appeal to all beings, no matter what race, no matter what gender. If you talk on a lower level, you're just appealing to certain genders. When you get into the mind and appeal on that level, that's when you get men and women coming in equal numbers to your retreats. Interesting question. That's just a stab at an answer. Any comments on that? Okay. Well, obviously there'll be much more women in the heaven realms. Please explain living meditation. P.S. Forgive me for asking more than my share of questions. I'm leaving tomorrow and will miss the question and answers attachment. Why, please explain, living meditation. Yes, I'm not quite sure what the questioner means like that, whether you mean trying to take meditation into your daily life and trying to do things in your daily life. Remember, in the daily life, it's full of things to do, sort of problems, full of difficulties, and you cannot really do as much deep meditation as you can here on a retreat. It would be nice to say that you can, but the truth is different. The life at home is full of things to do. Telephones, people coming and going, work, having to survive. That's why we have retreats, so we can pursue our meditation in the best of circumstances. When the Buddha taught, whether it was a Satipatthana Sutta or Anapanasati, his first instruction was that the meditator goes to a mountain, to a cave, to a forest, to an empty place, to a heap of straw, in an open area, away from the world. And this is what the Buddha said about meditation. You go away from the world to meditate. You don't go into the world to meditate, because the world is pulling you in another direction. We have retreat centers like this because there's nothing exciting to see. There's nothing pulling you out. It's tranquil, it's pacifying. It's so hard to do that in the world. That's why our monks' monastery and our nuns' monastery are in forests, away from the city, away from the noise. We do that in purpose. We say living meditation. I don't know if you mean, actually, I don't know really what that word actually means, living meditation. So, whether it's like trying to put meditation back into the world. Sometimes people have this idea of just being mindful, just being mindful, just being mindful, as if that's enough. But it's not enough. Recently, one of the monks in my monastery, just a few days ago actually, was talking about the effects of mindfulness. Is mindfulness enough? And I quoted one of the suttas, which he hadn't heard before, Manibhadra Yaka Sutta, in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Yaka Samyutta, where this being, this yaka, comes up to the Buddha. It's good yakas and bad yakas. This is a good one. And it was saying that anger can be overcome through mindfulness. And the Buddha corrected him, said, mindfulness is not enough. This is the Buddha saying, you cannot overcome anger just through being mindful. You have to use that in kindness. So some people go around saying, all you need to do in life is be mindful. It's not enough. Because the mindfulness is just the awareness where you put your attention, and so often where we put our attention is what we want to see, what we want to look at. It's controlled by, not wisdom, by defilements, by craving. So be very careful of just thinking that being mindful is enough. You need to get much deeper than that. I'm not quite sure if this answers the question at all. Any other comments on that? Maybe I misunderstood the question. So if somebody could re-ask it again, then if they even put it on a piece of paper. Sorry? Yeah?
I mean, if you're washing dishes, you have to have your mind on what you're doing.
Yes.
If you're driving a car, you have your mind only on the one thing.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, that's very good.
When I'm here, it's different.
Yes. Okay.
And how can I have loving kindness when I'm driving a car? Is it towards other traffic
people? Okay, very good. Okay, I understand this. I wouldn't really call this meditation, because meditation is all about letting go and making your mind very, very, very calm. This is more like learning to live wisely in the world, learning to cope wisely in this world. And a very good rule of thumb for you is the story of the Emperor's Three Questions, which is not from the Buddhist text. This is a story, a Russian folk tale, which I read in a book compiled by Tolstoy. There was an emperor who wanted to have a good philosophy for his life, and also, you know, wanted to be a good emperor. And after much thought and much discussion, he decided if he had the answer to these three questions, then he would satisfy himself religiously, philosophically, and I suppose empirically, emperor-like. That's probably not the right adjective, but it will do. And the three questions were this: what is the most important time, who is the most important person, and what's the most important thing to do? And the answer, which he found out after a long trial, was very Buddhist, and that's why I always remember this and teach this. So, what is the most important time? Not breakfast time. Well, why do you keep thinking about breakfast then? Now is the most important time, yeah. Now is that's the only time you've got. Now, who is the most important person?
You.
Me? Thank you very much. That's usually nice. You've heard it before, I haven't. Yeah. The answer was, most people actually haven't heard us before, we say oneself is the most important person. Because that's what our culture teaches. That's the wrong answer, and the most important person is the one you're with. And that's wonderful, to live your life. You know, someone's talking to you, or I'm giving an interview and someone's chatting to me, I want to give them 100% full attention. Doesn't matter who they are or what they're saying. They're saying stupid things. Hopefully that you'll never know. Because I treat you like with absolute full attention and with respect. Because I try and practice that. When someone's talking to me, they're the most important person in the world, I try and really listen. Because I know what it's like when I've been talking to someone and I know they're not listening at all. They're trying to get rid of me. I'm not important. And that's a rotten way of communicating with someone else. And it's also, you miss so much information. Those of you living in the world with children, with husbands, with wives, how often is it that you're talking to, say, your husband and he's just not listening? He's too busy. And you're just, at that moment, you're not the most important person in the world to him. Something else is more important. That's rotten when you feel like that. And if that happens too often, that's divorce. Or when your children are talking to you, and you're not really listening. It's the care. That's being halfway between being careful and being caring. Mindfulness and loving kindness, all joined together, care. So if you practice that in your world, and you're driving the car, the most important thing is the one you're with, the traffic around you. The most important time is now. Enjoy the moment. And the most important thing to do is care. Drive carefully and caringly. If someone wants to come in front of you, please come in. I was saying in Perth, I want to start a Buddhist footy team. Run on compassion. So if somebody wants to score a goal, the opposite team, you help them. They can't do it themselves, you put the ball in your own goal. You might not win very much matches, but you'd have good fun. So this is the most important thing to do, is to care. So when you're driving the car and you come to the red traffic lights, it's a marvellous opportunity just to stop and just to enjoy the moment. You can't go forward, you can't go backwards. Meditation. In Delhi, so I was told, the red traffic lights, instead of having STOP written on them, they've got the words RELAX. Relax. Isn't that brilliant? The municipal government in Delhi, India, when you get to the red traffic lights, instead of STOP, stop, they've got relax. It takes a lot of stress out of it, because you've got time there, you can just relax, enjoy the moment, and then when it goes to green again, you can go off again. So there's many opportunities for practicing meditation in life. Red traffic lights, relax, enjoy the moment. And then you're up again. And that's how you practice in daily life. One you're with is the most important person. Now's the most important time. You haven't got to work yet, so enjoy just being. And then you're preparing the mind for work. Don't think you've got to think about what you've got to say or what you've got to do when you get to work. Prepare your mind by resting, by relaxing, by making it joyful. Then you'll be efficient. So those are some ways of taking like wise attitudes into life. Are psychic premonitions, telepathy, etc. true, or are they the product of an overactive imagination? I knew someone was going to say that. That was a joke. I thought someone would laugh. Are psychic premonitions, telepathy, etc. true, or are they the product of an overactive imagination? I knew someone was going to write. Is it through meditations that skills are acquired, or is it sometimes innate? Okay. The psychic premonitions and telepathy are true, but most of the time, unless you're a very, very skilled advanced meditator, you don't know which ones are true and which ones are false. And sometimes you can even misinterpret them. I was told people a few days ago, just the first night I came here, about the man who dreamed of five angels. I don't think many of you. This was a man. He woke up in the morning. This is in Perth. And he just had this very vivid dream of five angels handing him five pots of gold. And like many of these dreams, you're just about to collect this fortune and you wake up. He was so disappointed because there was no gold in his bedroom at all. But when he went downstairs, the dream was still in his mind. He saw that his wife that morning had made five pieces of toast with five boiled eggs. He looked in the newspaper. It was the 5th of May, the 5th day of the 5th month. And he thought straight away that someone was trying to tell him something. So he looked in the back of the newspaper in the racing section, and sure enough, at the race course in Perth, Ascot, five letters, A-S-C-O-T, race number 5, horse number 5, was called Five Angels. And this was like too good to be true. But all the sides were telling him, so he took the afternoon off work. At lunchtime before going to the track, he took $5,000 out of his account to keep the lucky number 5. He went to the race track just to keep the luck. He chose the 5th bookmaker in line. And he put $5,000 on horse number 5, race number 5, Five Angels, $5,000 to win. You know what happened? Came in 5th. 5. So we've got premonitions sometimes, but we misunderstand them. That was a joke, but this other one is actually a true story. This actually did happen. There was a friend of ours, a disciple in Perth, who used to be a soldier in the British Army, and he married a Singapore girl while he was stationed in Singapore. So one day, just talking with his brothers-in-law, they decided to go to the racetrack that afternoon. But being Chinese, you know, what we call Jostic Buddhists, they decided to go to the temple first of all, for good luck. You know, burn some Jostics and go, you know, for luck. So they went to the temple, but they went to this one temple in the back streets of Singapore, which was supposed to be especially lucky. But when they got there, they found it was in a big mess. So they decided to, you know, get some brooms and get some mops out and clean it up. So the whole, you know, about 4 or 5 brothers-in-law and this Englishman cleaned up the temple. And then they went to the racetrack and they got cleaned up. They lost a lot of money. And they were sort of really disappointed. But that night, this Englishman had a dream. And he dreamt that someone told him the name of a horse. And when he got up in the morning, he still remembered it in the dream. He looked in the newspaper, it was running in the racetrack, exactly the same name, that afternoon. So he immediately rang his brothers-in-law and said, "Look, you know we cleaned up the temple yesterday. I've been told the name of a horse in my dream." And these Singaporean people would say, "Look, no temple god in Singapore will tell that to an Englishman. It can't be true." And so he went to the racetrack alone, and he won a fortune. It actually won. It was a premonition which came true for him. And his brothers-in-law were just so mad at that temple daver for telling Englishmen and not them. But those are stories that sometimes are true. So sometimes that these things are true, but we get it wrong. So don't trust these things. It's not just an overactive imagination. 99% of it is an overactive imagination, but every now and again something turns out to be true. The thing is, we don't know which are the true ones and which are the false ones. So this is why just to leave those things alone. Next one. Is a tree in a forest book a simile too? I'm not quite... A tree in the forest. Now, I can't remember actually a simile. There's many similes for trees in the forest. One of the nicest similes, which Ajahn Chah used to see of a tree in the forest, was that if you look at trees in the forest, I don't mean ones which are planted by the state government, I mean real forests, the trees are all over the place. They're leaning left, right, There are branches which are hanging off. They're gnarled, they're scarred. That's a forest. If you go to one which is planted by state government, they're all perfectly straight, they're in lines and they're in rows. Real natural perfection is all over the place, just like you. That is real perfection. But the trouble is that we strive in our idea of perfection to be just like a state forest. Everything nice and orderly in rows and columns, nice and straight. We're looking for perfection which doesn't really exist. When you understand the tree in the forest simile, you see that tree is perfect as it is, leaning over, a little bit diseased, brown leaves, twigs fallen off. That's what a real tree is, just like you. So developing that contentment and accepting of yourself as you are, in this moment, content, peaceful, that is the path which leads to stillness and enlightenment. In 1992-93, I heard Ajahn Jagrat wrote, "Oh, what joy to know there's no happiness in this world. How is this different from your talk?" Okay. "Do you have special Dharma talks for children? Thank you for your answers." I hope that doesn't mean the last question that you're not understanding what I'm saying at the moment. Special Dharma talks for children. No, sure that can't be. And in the happiness, no, joy at last, no, there's no happiness in this world. It's what that really means. It's a very profound saying. It means that once one realizes that this world can never have any lasting happiness, it means that you finally found out there's nothing wrong with you. It's not as if that you're strange, everyone else is enjoying themselves, but not you. You find that suffering is. What I'm saying here is that when you start leaving the world, this is what you do in meditation, then you get more and more happiness. You find that's the way to be happy. Not to find happiness in the world, but happiness outside of the world. But joy to know there's no happiness in this world is, and one of my Dzogchen similes, that most people spend their whole life searching for the tortoise with the moustache. Have you ever found a tortoise with a moustache? In other words, it's something which doesn't exist. Happiness in the world. The perfect relationship, then I'll be happy. Or winning $1 million, then I'll be happy. When the kids leave home, then I'll be happy. You're searching for a tortoise with a moustache. That sort of happiness you'll never find. But there's another happiness you can find, if it's outside of the world. I better actually go through this more quickly because I'm spending a lot of time here. Venerable Sir, this happiness we see is, I find, it occurring naturally inside and never had to look for it on the shelf. I hope I'm doing right. Thank you. The happiness we seek is, I find, occurring naturally inside and never have to look for it on the shelf. That's going well. If that's actually occurring for that questioner, it does mean that they've actually found that happiness on the shelf, and they find they can use perception to see the happy states. One of the sayings of the Buddha is that the Aryans have got such power over their perception that they can perceive the beauty in the ugly, and they can see the ugliness in the beauty. So you can use this. So that if something is attracting you, you can see the ugliness in it. So when I was a young monk, if there was a beautiful woman, I deliberately looked for the pimple. There's always one there somewhere. Just to get rid of the lust. If I saw someone who was abusing me, who was being an enemy, I would look for the beauty in them. Some redeeming quality in their character which I could respect and have loving kindness towards. I could always find that in the worst enemies. I remember one person telling me about one of their workmates who had never had a bad word to say about anybody. And that was really frustrating to these Australian workers. He had such a positive attitude. So one day they said, "Okay, what about Adolf Hitler? Say something nice about him." Without any hesitation, this man said, "Adolf Hitler, he was a leader in his field." So it's a lot of positive perceptions. It would be nice if the schedule as per timetable metta practice can be guided. Thank you. Oh, is that in the table? I'm telling people, like, no, you should read the instructions first of all. I haven't read the instructions, what I'm supposed to be doing. It's usually that I like to do that loving kindness meditation, a guided metta practice, at the end of a retreat rather than every evening, because I want to give people a lot of time just to do their own practice. Some people love loving kindness and some people hate it. The ones who really love it don't need to do it. The ones who hate it are the ones who need to do it. So I would do the guided loving kindness towards the end of the retreat if that's okay with people. But you can always do loving kindness meditation at any time during the retreat. Ajahn, I feel that I let go of the past and future at times and sometimes feel quite still and silent. What do I do when thoughts of past and future return? When they come back again, just very gently say, not now. This is a time for just being still and being peaceful and being in the present moment. So when the past knocks on your door, don't answer the door. You know what it's like with some of these salespeople or people selling religion? If you answer the door, you're in big trouble. But if you don't even answer the door, after a while they go away. So when the past knocks on your door, don't even answer. When it rings up, don't answer the phone. Future here. No thanks, not today, sorry. Now, this is what happens. You know, when a phone rings, very few people can actually leave it alone. They think that this might be something important. And how many times is it something really important? Only important calls only come when you're out of the house. If you're in the house, it just comes with a rubbish call. So don't go answering the phone all the time. And this is also, don't answer the phone when you're meditating. That's what the past and future is. So if you're wise, you hear the past and the future come to disturb you. Well, actually, a lot of time is that actually you go and disturb the past and future. Sometimes people are so restless, they've got the very present moment and they're thinking, what can I think of? Something to do. And so you actually go looking for something in the past to disturb yourself with, or something in the future to plan. And you don't really need to do it at all. So, have that mindfulness that you can keep the past and the future out, and if they start, try and creep in, say, not now. Keep them out. It's very easy to keep them out if they haven't established themselves in your door. When they're outside the door, it's very easy to keep the salespeople out. But once they've got the foot in the door, you're in trouble. So don't allow the past or the future even to get a foothold in the mind. And it's quite easy. And also just enjoy the present moment, so the past and the future don't have a chance, because your whole mind is filled with the beauty of the present. And past and future, just like a child, but don't worry about the past and future. You used to be like that once. Life isn't so simple. You can't always be in the present moment, but at least on a retreat, there's no reason why you can't spend all the time just being there. I am very sensitive, feel hurt often and easily. Does this mean I am full of self? Is it ego? Please explain. Non-self. Being a beginner meditator, I need regular guidance. How and where is this available possible? Any alternatives? I cannot understand just by reading. Stories help. Do you have to be intelligent to be a Buddhist? Thank you. I'm very sensitive. Does this mean I'm full of self, ego? You hurt easily. It just means that one gets hurt easy if one doesn't know who one is, first of all. One isn't quite sure. In other words, if someone calls you a fool or an idiot, the only reason that you get hurt is because you believe them, or at least you think they may be true. If you were quite sure you weren't an idiot or a fool, you wouldn't get hurt. If someone called you an idiot, you'd just go up and say, I'm sorry, sir, but you're wrong. This is Ajahn Chah's famous simile, and the person who asks this question should always remember this. If someone calls you a dog, you should look at your bottom to see if you've got a tail. And if you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog, end of story. If you haven't got a tail, then say thank you for pointing out to me. In other words, if what they say is right, if you have been an idiot, then say thank you. You're right. But most of the time, you believe what's not true. Now, also, it means have a sense of humour. One of the things I was taught when I was a young teacher, was, you know, if you make a mistake and the kids start laughing, laugh with them. And then they're not laughing at you anymore. But everyone's enjoying the joke. You know what it's like being a monk? Many years ago, when I was a young monk, when we used to be in Magnolia Street, this was about 15, 16 years ago, I was loading our van, an old combi van, with some stuff to take down to the monastery. This was in the middle of North Perth. And this young, about 12-year-old girl came out and looked at me with utter disgust. She looked at me up and down, sneering. And she said with this really demeaning voice, she said, "You're dressed like a girl. That's sick. Yuck." I burst out laughing. I saw the funny side of it. And that completely disarmed her, because she was saying that just to really upset me, and I just refused to get upset. But I saw the funny side, and I told a lot of people that. It's a really funny story. instead of feeling hurt, you laugh at yourself, you have that feeling of confidence, and it doesn't matter what people say about you. You know, even if it's true, I make mistakes, everyone makes mistakes, so I don't mind them being pointed out. So, with practice of meditation and the resulting wisdom, now you find that what people say to you doesn't offend you at all. It's either true or it's false. If it's false, you don't even carry it around even for a second. And if it's true, you say thank you and you laugh with them and you try and do better next time. That's what it means. And a beginner, you need better guidance, how and where is available possible, any alternatives. Again, so the guidance can be from books or from tapes. The best guidance is from your own practice, from experience as the greatest teacher. Get in there, meditate a lot and see what happens. And there's always good monks around Melbourne. You can go and see those. People like Ajahn Eyan or Ajahn Wajira or Gina Lankara. Go and see those, ask for tips for meditation, they'll all be able to help you. But anyway, no need to feel hurt. Use those similes. So if someone calls you a dog, look at your bottom, see if you've got a tail. And if they do say something funny with you, just laugh with them. So they're not laughing at you, you're laughing with them. When observing the breath, taking a mental note of where it starts and where it finishes. When do you stop making a mental note? You can make a mental note of the breath at the very beginning, just to sort of anchor yourself, to give yourself something to think about, to fill up the space, basically. But once the mind settles down, the mental note should all be given up, and you go to the bare feeling of the breath. As you calm down more and more and more, you don't need these notes anymore to tell you where the breath is. You know where it is. Just like when you're playing the piano, you have all these rules of what you should do. You know, all the keys and everything else. After a while, you just know how to play the piano. You don't need those rules. Driving a car. You know, you look at the road guide when you begin. But how many of you now are driving a car and look at the road guide anymore? You know how to drive. So after a while of doing the breath meditation, you don't need any more mental notes. You know how to do it. So use a mental noting at the very beginning, but don't carry on too long. If when seated in jhana, a person lifts one up, does the posture change? Is the body of this person heavier to lift as in an unconscious person? That's an interesting question. The posture does change. Yeah, you can sort of open it out or whatever. Is a person heavier to lift as an unconscious person? I'm not sure. I don't know that one. It's an interesting question. I think someone's been thinking too much. But certainly the posture can change, because the body is just supple. It's not like rigid like a rock. So the posture can be changed, but you don't know it. Number 3, is it possible to explain metta meditation the way you teach it to your students? That's a big question, and again, metta meditation, I'm going to be talking about metta meditation later during the week, the whole talk on metta meditation, because it's so important, and how we can actually even combine it with breath meditation, just to make everything sort of come together in a beautiful way. So that'll be a talk, and if you're not going to be staying for the retreat, you can always ask for the whole retreat, you can always ask for that talk later on, once the retreat finishes. Please offer up a teaching which might lead me to more mindfulness during rest period, i.e. opening and closing doors with care, not using hand dryers, walking along corridor with some presence of mind, as on walking meditation. Okay, so someone's being a bit disturbed here with during the rest period, people making too much noise. It's a very difficult one, because we could make this retreat like an army camp, and anyone who makes a noise gets kicked out. But sometimes that would make people just too stressful, because they get too much of that in their daily life. What you can say is that when you are resting and people make noise, you can actually come up and just tell them very gently, please, and try and be more mindful of everybody what you're making noise. But realize when you've got so many people together, there'll always be some noise. And the only thing you can do when there's such noise is that when the door stops banging, don't allow it to echo in your mind. Echoing in the mind means the door bangs, and then you start thinking, why are they making the door bang? They shouldn't make the door bang. I'm going to write a question to Ajahn Brahm about this. If he doesn't do anything, I'm not going to come to any more retreats, and I'm going to tell him that. But the bang finished a long time ago, and so the thoughts carry on for a long time afterwards. You can't get rid of the bang, but you can get rid of the echoes in the mind. And a lot of time, that's the main problem. As I was saying when I first talked, even in the most perfect retreat center, even if everyone sort of had these cushioned slippers, and even if we had like the doors sort of were automatically closing sliding doors which were absolutely silent, and your rooms were double glazed, triple glazed with soundproof doors, you sit and you had air conditioners, just a little sort of duct of air just right above you with control, so you can get just the right temperature just for you, because the person sitting next to you, what's cold for you is warm for them, what's warm for them is cold for you. You still find something to complain about. Even if you had a menu, for lunch and breakfast, even if you have dinner as well, and you had a menu, and room service with butler, you still have something to complain about. The fault-finding mind is like that. No matter how perfect it is, there was this story of this man who was up in heaven. And when he was up in heaven, he started getting a bit fed up with ambrosia every day and harp music. And he had this vision. And in this vision, he saw like the hell realms. Only the hell realms were nothing like he'd expected them to be. Instead of like having ambrosia, they had delicious vegetarian food, steak and chips, Hungry Jacks, whatever you wanted. And he used to like sort of some fish and chips. You will never get up in heaven. And not only that, instead of harp music, that is really good rock bands. Jimi Hendrix and all this Elvis Presley. And really some nice music, which he really loved. And instead of all the girls, instead of all the girls wearing white sheets, they all had really nice clothes on. Really attractive, and so were the men. And so he went up to the angel to complain. He said, look, I worked hard to get up into heaven. I sacrificed a lot to come up here. Surely we could have a bit more happiness up here. Let's have some good music instead of these stupid harps all day. And let's get the angels to dress a bit more attractively. And let's do something about the menu, because after a couple of centuries, sort of ambrosia in the morning for breakfast and lunch and dinner, day after day, it gets a bit much. Let's have some junk food up here. You can only die once, you don't have to worry about cholesterol up in heaven. And the angel said, look, sorry, tradition. It's been like this for thousands of years, we can't change it. And this is not good enough tradition. I want some happiness and fun. I want my rock music. I want my pretty girls. I want my nice food. And the angel was adamant, look, you can't do this, tradition. But the angel said, well, look, what we can do, if you really want that, we can arrange for you to go down there. He said, okay, because it's much better, you know, having all that beautiful stuff instead of all this. In fact, real hell is up here with all this stupid ambrosia and harp music. And so he went down to hell. And as soon as he got down to hell, these ugly looking demons took hold of him and put him in a vat of boiling oil and started prodding him with these forks. He said, hang on, hang on. He said, what about the beautiful girls and the nice rock music and the beautiful food? And the imps, the devils down there, said, oh, that's our advertising campaign. So, that's what happens to you when you complain. So you always think that the other retreat centre is happier. Or everything will be nice if you get rid of this one annoying person on this retreat. But, so, don't have a complaining mind, a fault-finding mind. The people making the noise, maybe it's the only thing they can do. Maybe they're really trying their hardest. And maybe this is their first retreat. And if they get told off, this actually happened in our centre in Perth once. This lady came to our centre to listen to the Friday night talk. And she lay down, fell asleep and started snoring. And somebody came up to her and said, look, giving a talk, you shouldn't sort of lay down like this, you shouldn't snore. And she was so embarrassed that she walked outside and she was talking to someone on the way and never came back again. The point was that she was having a lot of abuse from her husband at home. And she was just so mentally tired, this was a safe place where she just came just to get away. When it was explained to people what was actually happening to her, they felt so rotten about being so uncompassionate to a person in enormous suffering. They didn't just let her. You could still hear my talk. It didn't really matter if she was pointing the feet at me. So what? That's the best she could do. She wasn't doing it out of disrespect. She knew no better. And she was really struggling with a lot of suffering. So it was a good message to everybody to be a bit kinder. Don't be so judgmental. How does someone perceive the toilet smell as beautiful and pleasant without aversion? We have some nice questions late at night, don't we? Is there the tendency to be attached when one perceives everything in the world as beautiful, even when the world is suffering, flooded or sick? It's interesting that I think in my 6 reigns as a monk, I found a nice secluded spot in the mountains in the north of Thailand, where there was a beautiful cave. The cave had lots of bats in it, but it was such a big cave that you could go to a place where there's hardly any bats. I had some such wonderful meditation in that place. I was alone for about 6 months. And just myself in this monastery. It was such a nice time there. That to this day, whenever I smell bat shit, I love the smell. Because it's associated with happy memories. I love the smell of bat shit. If in this retreat you have such a lovely time, then you associate the smell of the toilets with a lovely time in this retreat, and it's a nice smell. And that's interesting because it's association. The other thing which is a nice smell to me is always tar. But I couldn't figure out what was the association with my youth. So I loved the smell of tar, and I remembered it was the local park, the local field where I used to spend just so much time playing soccer and messing around with my friends. During the Second World War, the iron railings had to be sold to the government to be melted down to make tanks shells and bombs and stuff. And so they had to replace all these iron railings with wooden railings, and to protect them from the weather, they'd always be painting with tar all the time. And because I had so many happy memories of my youth playing and getting into trouble in that park, and that park was just rife with the smell of tar, To this day, when I smell tar, it's a beautiful smell. I just feel so happy with that smell of tar or batshit. Two of my favourite smells. It's just goes association, that's all. So even the smell of a toilet, it's not essentially something which gives aversion. It's because there are associations. That's why it gives aversion. And therefore, we can actually change it around if we really want to. If you're really constipated, then you'd love the smell of, you know, the, the toilets. Oh, amazing! I'm free of constipation now. So you can actually change anything around. And this is something which we play with. We actually try and get a good association with an unpleasant experience. And then the unpleasant perception disappears and we make it pleasant. It's actually we add the unpleasantness or the pleasantness to the experience. Life is just like this children's colouring book. Black lines on white paper. And that which we call perception colours it in. Some people are so negative they colour it all in black. In really rotten colours. And it's just our habit to do that. Some people, they can decide, they've got the choice, they can use the bright coloured crayons if they really want to. And you can enjoy those things. The important thing, as I was saying earlier, if you are wise, that which you're attached to, you develop the unpleasant perceptions. Just to make sure that you're balanced and you don't get stuck in those things. If you're really into wealth and possessions, develop the perceptions of the bother and the burden of possessions so that you don't get caught in those things. If you're really attached to a person, then in order to be more equanimous to that person, develop the perception of death, that one day you'll be separated from that. If you're really angry at a person, develop the beautiful perceptions about them, that they're another human being in this world who's striving to do the best they can. Let's give them some loving kindness. If you have pain, see if you can develop the perception this pain is the body telling you something. You need to change your posture. Or sometimes it's healing pain. As someone once very beautifully said, like pain is sometimes like the pressure in a flower, in the bud, just before it's about to burst forth. This beautiful flower just enclosed in this bud, just bursting with energy. And it must be very painful, it's just so tight and so tense in there, and it's just before this beautiful flowering of wisdom comes. Or as you've heard me say before, that sometimes the pain is like the dung, which can, if you know how to deal with it, can be fertilizer for your garden. You can get so wise through pain. So this is how you can take away the perceptions, which are negative, and put positive perceptions around it, and it is much easier to deal with. I've been telling a lot of people, just before I left Perth, a story of when I was a young monk and used to sit in the back, I think I told this at BSV, didn't I? Used to sit in the back of a truck to go places, and all the roads had potholes in them. And when the truck went into a pothole, the truck went down, I went up and clapped my head on the steel railings of the car. And I'd only been a monk a very short time, and so when I clapped my head on the railings, it really hurt, I swore. There's only other monks in the car, so it didn't matter. And they could only speak Thai, and I was swearing in English, so it was okay. But that's what you did, isn't it? Look at other people when they hit their foot. They start to swear or say rude words. But when I saw the Thai monks hit their head, they didn't swear, they laughed. And I thought they were really crazy or they hit their head too much. And I didn't understand what was going on until I decided, like being an ex-scientist, to actually experiment. So the next time I hit my head, I decided to laugh. And I found out the secret. If you laugh at pain, it hurts less. If you swear at it, it hurts much more. And even the doctors would say, once you start laughing, endorphins are secreted into the bloodstream, nature's painkillers, it actually literally hurts less if you laugh. But when you swear, it hurts much more. This is just perception, isn't it? So you can actually turn pain around and laugh at pain. It doesn't hurt so much. One of my favourite people in history was St. Lawrence, Catholic saint. He was being burnt at the stake. Now, I think you all know, probably you've all burned yourself sometime in your life, even a finger. How much does that hurt? Right. The pain of burning is one of the worst pains for a human being. And this poor man was being burnt, not just on his finger, all over, burnt alive. And just before he lost consciousness, he said these words, his last recorded words. They were in Latin, they were translated, they said, "Turn me over, this side's done." That's why he's one of my favourite people, because he cracked a joke just when he's dying. So not only was he beyond pain and beyond aversion to pain, he was also compassionate to all those miserable people looking around and watching him being burnt to death. It was not the most pleasant thing to do. He wanted to cheer everyone up, so he told a joke. Which showed it can be done. It is done, it will be done. So pain becomes suffering because what we add to it. The "I don't want," "I can't stand," "get away from here." That's what causes the problem. If you can have full acceptance of pain, just be. Pain, you can be here for the rest of my life. I don't mind. I can live with you. If you can really say that honestly, then pain disappears. So that's actually perceptions again. And the perceptions are incredibly powerful. That's why the Buddha said doing meditation is playing around with perceptions and learning to be skillful with playing with perceptions, which gives you a lot of freedom. Someone you would usually dislike, you can turn it around and see something you like in them, so you don't get angry at them or averse to them. Someone you would really be attracted to, you can just see something, a fault in them, and then you don't get so attracted. When you go shopping, you can see all the faults in the goods, so you don't spend all that money. All those different things. Why do people buy things? It's just a perception, the beautiful boxes, the beautiful coverings, the packaging. It's all playing with perceptions, that's all. And we get sucked in every time. Hajan, if this question is not suitable, please throw it away. This is interesting, isn't it? It wakes people up. Thank you very much. What is this? This is my first retreat. I have noticed that more than 50% of the group appear to have very distressed facial expressions. This is an excellent question. Aren't you supposed to smile when you're on retreat? Is it suffering, aches and pains? I believe it's a happy and relaxed environment. Can you do anything to help? There you are. Yeah, okay. This is one of the most important instructions for meditation on this retreat. So I want everyone to try and do this tomorrow morning. You've heard me say this before. When you get up in the morning, one of the first things you do is go to the toilet, go to the bathroom. In that bathroom, there will be a mirror. Stand in front of that mirror and smile at yourself. If it's 4 o'clock in the morning and it's difficult to smile at yourself for that hour, this is what my meditation teacher told me, and it worked. Get your two fingers like this, put them on the side of your mouth and push up. You do it. It wasn't a joke. Actually, my first meditation when I was at Cambridge University told me this, and I did that for 3 years. And that's why I smile easily. It's just practice, that's all. I began each day laughing. If I couldn't actually get a normal smile, I saw this stupid young man putting his two fingers up and trying to smile. And of course, that made me smile naturally. And I saw this figure in the mirror smiling. I ended up laughing at myself. I laugh at myself every morning for 3 years. Now, if that isn't psychologically potent, I don't know what is. No matter how much suffering you have, you do that and you can't help laughing. And that starts you with a smile on your face, which means you're going to work, and that smile usually lingers a long time. And then you're smiling. And with that smiling, it's psychologically, it's pointing in the direction of looking for happiness. You're not looking for sadness. And the perception of happiness starts to increase. So this is your first retreat. This is only the first couple of days. So please, if you wait until the last day of the retreat, everyone will be smiling. Because they know that the next day they're going home. Okay, thanks, Krishna. Let's keep going. In metta meditation, why is it said, "My Arjuna were unhappy," as the first line of the meditation thought? Please explain. When I teach meditation, metta meditation, I don't say that as your first line. I think that's very unskillful to say it as the first line, because metta meditation, using the simile of lighting a fire, you don't start lighting a fire with wet, sappy logs. You use things which are very easy to develop loving kindness towards. And for a lot of people, you're way down the line there. Now choose someone who is easy to love, or something like a dog or a cat, which you can easily give loving kindness towards. Then when loving kindness is strong, when you've done your little pet dog or your pet cat, when you've done sort of the people you're very fond of, when you've done your close family and your loved ones, then do yourself. You find if you leave yourself to that time, the warmth of loving kindness is strong enough, it's easy to be kind to yourself and easy to love yourself. But again, I'll talk more about that later on when I talk about loving kindness meditation. Can you tell us a bit about what happens at a Buddhist funeral? What are the rituals and their significance? Thank you. It's very good that people are planning their funeral right now. What happens at a Buddhist funeral? But obviously, Buddhist funeral has to be sensitive. It's got two main purposes to it. One is for the person who's passed away, and the other one is for those who are left behind. Never think that the person who's passed away has disappeared and gone, because very often they linger around for quite a while after they die. Once, when I was in Thailand, there was...